Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Great.
Oh.
There's not a lot I can do about that, I'm afraid. I mean, I do write plays for the radio, so I'm amazing. So it's kind of oral. It's going to be an oral presentation then. Yep. So I'm afraid you're only going to get the serial killer side of me today. I didn't sleep well, so there we go. Never mind. Okay, let's just launch into it, shall we? So recently, when I was unable to sleep, I was thinking about the word camp. This is what I sometimes do when I can't sleep. I think about words, but it doesn't help particularly. So I was thinking about the word camp, trying to define what camp meant, and it didn't seem at all obvious to me. And then I thought, well, what's the opposite of camp, the very opposite of camp? What's anti-camp? And that seemed clearer. Like a Church of Scotland sermon is the kind of epitome of anti-camp. And I used to go to a lot of these Church of Scotland sermons, and they were memorable by the fact that they were so unmemorable in a way. They were so incredibly dull. It wasn't hellfire and brimstone or anything like that. In a way, it was basically cease to do evil, do good. In some ways, it was quite worthy sentiments. But there was nothing to hang it on. There were no stories. There was very, very little imagery, no painting or anything like that to hang that on. So it was kind of content without style, really. Content without style. After I stopped going to church, I started going to the theatre, and I went to the Glasgow Citizens Theatre in Glasgow quite a bit. And I remember going there and just being very, very excited to be in the theatre, especially just before the play started. They had a brilliant designer. He came up with these beautiful, beautiful designs, silvers and gold and scarlets. And the best part was just waiting for the play to begin. I just had a real potential of theatre, and it was very exciting. And then the play began, and after about 10 minutes, I had to admit to myself that I was just really, really bored. Because their style was very camp. It was kind of style, very much kind of style over content. They had all these beautiful moves and beautiful costumes and beautiful scenery, but I just couldn't, you know, I just couldn't engage with it. I mean, they destroyed everything from Oscar Wilde even to, I don't know, Pinter and Shakespeare. So it was kind of style without any content, really. The Citizens Theatre. And not long after I left school, I went to university and did English literature and drama. And I came across the movement in about 1983, I think, and moved into a community very, very quickly. And I definitely felt I'd arrived. I was definitely home. The English literature and the drama that I did, there just wasn't enough to hang a life on, even though I loved it. But at the same time, in the community, all the images and whatsoever just seemed a little bit alien to me. I couldn't quite connect. I felt in this kind of strange in-between state, not quite able to kind of access the Buddhist imagery, but knowing very well that I'd arrived and knowing that literature and drama weren't enough. So I think what I really wanted was a cultural life imbued with spirituality and meaning. And I also wanted a spiritual life imbued with engaging familiar cultural forms. That's what I really wanted. And it didn't have it, and it was painful. And to some extent, it's still the case. I still feel in this kind of in-between stage. Although, you know, I'm very much a Buddhist. But I guess I've got to be patient, because it's going to take a couple of hundred years for religion and art to come together again, to come back together. It's going to take that long, really. But of course, a start has been made. And I remember when I first read The Religion of Art, Bhante's Religion of Art, And it was just kind of thrilling, really. The style was a bit strange, slightly old-fashioned. But everything that lay behind it, I just found really exciting. It just seemed to be speaking directly to me. And since then, you know, Banti's emphasis on the arts, on the importance of Buddhism being embedded in our culture has been a kind of real inspiration. You know, he had the foresight years ago to write that book, to talk about the importance of bringing spirituality and meaning and our cultural life together. Alaka has talked about the necessity for the movement creating compelling images, without which, you know, the movement will die. And I asked him about that because it sounded quite an extreme statement. I asked if did he actually say that, and he said yes, but it was very much in the context of what Banti was talking about in terms of the mythic context. But presumably not just compelling images. We need compelling stories and compelling music, all sorts of compelling things that move us in the direction that we want to go. So when we first got the centre in Norwich, I was given kind of carte blanche to talk to Alaka about the kind of what we wanted for our shrine, piece. And he came up with a triptych, or an urban Buddha, a city Buddha, which I really, really love. And I really enjoyed going to visit Alaka and talking about it. I wasn't sure exactly what we wanted. I think originally I suggested we had a Buddha over Norwich, and Alaka persuaded me that this was a barmy idea, to have the Buddha kind of floating over the cathedral like a kind of barrage balloon. But we had lots of conversations about, you know, he was talking about art, and I was partly talking about the city and working in the city and how that might be expressed in an image. And when he finally came up with the image, it was really, I found it really, again, thrilling, because he could see little, and I'm sure, you know, some of you experienced this talking with Alaka and him producing images for you. I could see little bits of the conversations in there, you know, the echoes of the cathedral and that kind of thing, that he'd managed to kind of incorporate and integrate into the triptych. And I think it was one of the most engaging times since I'd left university, in that the two worlds seemed to come together, kind of culture and meaning, and it was very exciting. So sometimes we can see the arts as a kind of a bit of a fringe thing. You know, you have a bit of ado for someone when they go off to Gukuloka or something like that. But of course, what Banti has always talked about is a real integration, a real synthesis, a real necessity of synthesizing, bringing together religion and art, showing that they are ultimately the one thing. So in a way, in this talk, I've really got only one point to make. And that is, and partly I'm talking to myself. Often when we give talks, we talk to ourselves, don't we? I must be more mindful, that kind of thing, when you're probably the most unmindful person. Anyway, so what I'm trying to say to myself is we could do more to communicate the Dharma through the arts, within the movement and beyond. And I think we're well placed to do that, especially with Banti's emphasis on the religion of art. So one of the main ways, am I talking too fast? No. One of the main ways we communicate the Dharma, of course, is like Dharma talks, like this one. And it's, you know, absolutely vital to be conceptually clear. But we also need to contact the mythic context as well. And we do that in talks to a certain extent. But I think using the arts, communicating the Dharma through the arts, is just a very, very effective way of communicating the mythic context, whatever that might be, a sense of mystery or beauty, or however you'd like to do it, talk about it. We've all got this great resource, Free Buddhist Audio, all these marvellous talks, and they are marvellous. But how many guitars do you hear in them? I mean, it would be great to have a kind of whole resource for stories and drama and music as well. Because, you know, we're hungry for it, really. And people are hungry for it. I went to see a production of Every Man at the, can't remember where, it was the National Theatre in London. And it was by Carol Ann, I think it was by Carol Ann Duffy, who presumably is a kind of secular artist. And, you know, it was quite good, but I just had a sense that Every Man's a medieval religious morality play, so it was a kind of update of it. And it didn't quite work, because you didn't get a huge sense of kind of spirituality or real meaning at all. In a way, you got a sense of puzzlement and bafflement. And I can't remember the particular line, but there might have been a line like, how do you find meaning without God? That wasn't the line, it was something like that. And when the actor said that, there was a real kind of hush in the auditorium. And you just had a sense that, yeah, people were kind of hungry for meaning, but hungry to be kind of communicated meaning, perhaps in a theatrical environment. But, yeah, it was very strong. People are hungry for it. I'm kind of hungry for the synthesis of kind of cultural forms and spirituality. I realise I get quite I've wade through Amazon and go through all the DVDs in Norwich Library. I'm often searching for something, and often I don't find it. Or I'll watch a film, and a bit like Kimitri Bandu was saying yesterday, at the end of it I think, oh, that was quite good, but I still feel a bit hungry somehow. You know, I feel hungry for this kind of synthesis. A friend gave me a book called Cinema Nirvana recently, and it's got little dents where I've kind of thrown it across the room. It's a Buddhist reading of Hollywood films, and one of the chapters is about Clint Eastwood. There's another chapter about Jaws. It's very cleverly done, but it just infuriated me, and I don't know why it kind of enrages me so much. I mean, if I'm ever in a coma, just read this book over my prostate corpse, and I'm sure I'll revive. And I have still work to do. He talked about James Bond as a budding Buddha, which particularly got up my nose. I mean, as if the Buddha was some kind of emotionally stunted sadist or something like that. But I think it really annoyed me, because I want the real thing. I don't want to be, you know, after so many years on a spiritual path, being, you know, I don't want to have to settle for James Bond or Clint Eastwood. You know, I want the real thing. And there are things, you know, there are things out there. It's not that there aren't things out there. I was reading a book about avant-garde theatre recently, and just the number of times the word religion and spirituality came up, that you know, many of these kind of producers off Broadway and Peter Brook, people like that, are really kind of searching for this kind of synthesis of meaning and form. And it's interesting how some of them eventually give up theatre altogether and go on a kind of spiritual kind of quest. There's a Polish director, is it Grotowski? I think he took various followers up a mountain or something like that. But there's a real kind of search there. So things are out there, but I think we are really well placed to really help with this synthesis. So I think there was a school of thought that said that the arts are something you appreciate but don't necessarily do. And, you know, I've got a close friend who's very close, actually, in physical proximity, you know, who was hammered at one point for attempting to write poems or be a poet or put on a play. I was quite lucky in that, you know, I never had any discouragement at all, quite the opposite in Glasgow. And I was also quite lucky in very early on, before I was ordained, going down to Padmaloka on these arts retreats that COVIDA organised, and Chintamani and various others. I'm really grateful to COVIDA and Chintamani for those. COVIDA is no longer an order member, unfortunately. But we had these rituals that Chintamani, I don't think he realised the sort of powers he'd unleashed in those particular rituals. Anyway, there was one particular ritual, a sky ritual. And I just have this image of Kovada bounding across the lawn, flapping his arms and making birdie noises. And I remember seeing him and thinking, yes, I think I can join this order. I felt at home again. And we used the Tibetan Wheel of Life and the Tibetan Book of the Dead as a kind of models or templates for these retreats. Subhuti would give a talk in the morning, and then the rest of us would go off and kind of create a drama or some kind of musical thing to reflect the particular realm. And these images just really, really stuck in my mind. I think they're the two of the best retreats are the two of the most effective or striking retreats I've ever done, and the images are still there. Remember Vajranatha is a surprisingly beautiful flapper in the god realm. I don't know why I said surprisingly there, I'm sorry about that. I think it must be the beard. And there was Alaka, and there was Chintamani, and there was Ananda, and other people around who were just getting on with it, really. So we do it already. You know, we do communicate the Dharma through the arts already. In the shrines we do, in the poems we read, in talks, in our chants. We are very creative. And all I'm suggesting, and I'm talking to myself, is we could do much more. See art and a spirituality much more kind of synthesized. So why should we do that? So I think one of the phrases that came to me is what the arts can communicate very well is the fact that we are not alone. You know, C.S. Lewis talked about we read to remind ourselves that we're not alone. And this is what the Buddha did when he talked about dukkha. This feeling of isolation, this feeling of disconnection, isn't particular to you. It's the human condition. And just as the Buddha articulated that, so artists, in a kind of general sense, articulate the same thing. Articulate which might be semi-articulate in ourselves, or even inarticulate. And in doing that, showing that it's the human condition and not just particular to us, it opens kind of channels of, the possibility of compassion and connection. So there's an Emily Dickinson poem, I'll see if I can remember it. Down time's quaint stream without an oar, we are enforced to sail, our port a secret, our perchance a gale. What skipper would incur the risk? What buccaneer would ride without a surety from the wind or a schedule from the tide? And I remember reading that and just having a sense of connection with the writer, that I'm not alone, and this sense of the haphazardness of life suddenly being communicated so well. And we can do this for each other, and we can do it for the world. I do a lot of school visits, and this poem came to mind on one visit. I'm a bit off the point, but I was talking about ethics, and a little kid, I think he was only about seven, put up his hand, and he says to me, do adults lie as well? And I couldn't very well say no. The little kid next to him, who was a bit more streetwise, said something like, yes, they do. And the next time your mummy says there's no Santa, don't believe her. But I just had the sense of this little kid kind of sent out on this kind of wide ocean, and kind of that Emily Dickinson poem came to mind. Anyway, I think this is what kind of stand-up comedy attempts to do. Alan Bennett talks about the stand-up dealing in a currency they hope is communal. Starting often there's the phrase, have you ever noticed, or whatever. I tend not to like stand-up comedy that much. I find it generally a bit arrogant and belligerent. Certainly a wee bit belligerent and cynical at times. And I wondered what stand-up tragedy might be like. I think that would be... I don't know if I've invented the genre, but I kind of... I'm quite attracted to the idea. I get a prop out, all right. This is very fragile. Okay, let's see if this works. Okay. Don't you see that? My mother-in-law is so fat that it's no good. What did Tommy Cooper, Sid James and Molière have in common? Answer, they all died on stage. Sid James had a heart attack in Sunderland while he was doing a farce. Tommy Cooper collapsed at His Majesty's and got a big laugh till he realised what had happened. And Molière hemorrhaged, collapsed, got up again because the show must go on, hemorrhaged, collapsed and died 2 hours later. I myself died in Huddersfield 3 months ago. 2 days after that, I died in Burnley. 2 days after that, in Grimsby. People just stopped finding me funny. I stopped finding me funny. And instead of all this laughter and appreciation coming at me, there was all this embarrassment and anger and pity. And finally, and irrevocably, I died in Whitby 2 weeks ago. I just froze. My routine went right out my head. And I just entered this terrible place of silence. The seconds ticking away. And finally, I just walked off. And that night, in my bed and breakfast, I tossed and turned. I couldn't get to sleep. And finally, I decided that's it. Me and comedy are through. And that were a great relief. But then I go down to my breakfast and the landlady says, would you like kippers, a full English, or would you like cornflakes? And I didn't know. I was still terrified. The routine had gone out of my head. So I got up without any breakfast. I went onto the beach to try and calm myself down, you see. But it were no good. The fear was still there. You see, my life, I don't know what's going to come next. You don't know what's going to come next. You never know what's going to come next. Work in progress, I think. Another thing the arts does so well. Hold on. All right. Back from serial killer mode to normal mode. The arts is really, well, can be very good at generating empathy and sympathy, and particularly movies, maybe. I can't substantiate this point, but I'm sure I read somewhere of Banti saying that if he knew how powerful films were, how popular films were, how they can create a sense of empathy, he might have become a filmmaker. Have I just made that up? Does anyone else remember that? I'm sure I remember something like that, but don't quote me. Yeah. So I won't talk about sympathy and empathy too much, but there's this other phrase that we use a lot. One of the chief ways the arts can help us with... I can't read my writing. Is this phrase, finding emotional equivalence to our intellectual understanding. And it does it via enjoyment and pleasure. There's so much enjoyment and pleasure kind of bound up in the music we listen to, the films we watch, and the books we read. A friend did a Buddhism course, and 1 week was on the arts. And it wasn't gender that, you know, caused the problem. It wasn't sexuality or anything like that that caused the problem. It was the arts. The kind of place erupted that night. There was blood in the walls, really. Because, you know, we kind of fiercely... champion our particular enjoyments, don't we? So we might intellectually understand that actions have consequences. We see a play of Macbeth and it gets rooted into our heart and our guts, really. We might know intellectually that things are transient and passing. We hear the skylark or the power of music makes us realise it. And again, Banti's, he's always talked about having a choir at every centre, the way that music can kind of move us in that way. Because if you think of how the Buddha communicated, it was probably not like a Church of Scotland sermon. All things are impermanent, with mindfulness, strive on. It was an udana, wasn't it? It was a breathing out. It was an inspiration. People's hair went on end and they kind of sweated and things like that. It was more like beautiful song or kind of beautiful poetry, really. If you think of the parinirvana, and I'm sure people have made this point before, the Buddha dying, this kind of wrecked body about to kind of totally collapse. With mindfulness, all things are impermanent. So it was like the kind of zenith of performance art in a way. You know, here's this decaying, dying body, all things are impermanent. Remember one retreat, I think it was a Parinirvana Day celebration at Padmaloka, and Priyavadatta did the shrine. And on the courtyard, the Dardo Rinpoche stupa, he put an old battered wheelbarrow. It sounds a bit weird, doesn't it? But actually, it worked really, really well. You came into the courtyard ready to circumambulate the stupa and see this, you know, see the lovely stupa. And suddenly you were faced with this kind of battered old wheelbarrow with a burst tire and holes in the sides and things like that. And I remember him looking out at people kind of being shocked by this and chuckling away to himself. I think it was a bit of inspiration, really. It took a bit of a risk, but... you know, it was a very interesting experience. So I suppose that's showing, not telling, isn't it? That's showing, not telling, which is the title of the talk. So again and again in these playwriting books, you get this advice to show and not to tell. And it's very difficult. But what I like about drama is that no one character needs to speak the truth. The truth can emerge through a dialogue. There was one book I read by a writer called D.J. Taylor, who was talking. It was from the. It was about two comedians, and it was written from the stand-up. It was written by the straight man, and. He was talking about his friend who was a comic genius. But unfortunately, there were no laughs in the book. You were just told this again and again. It was never kind of revealed. It was never kind of shown. And that really kind of challenges your Dharma practice. I think if you want to reveal the Dharma through words or music or images, it really challenges our own understanding and our own insights, such as they are. On that retreat, I was talking about the one that Vajranath and I and lots of other people were on, the Game of Life retreat. We did a little drama for each of the realms, like the Deva realm and the Asura realm. And what was most difficult was at the end, we wanted to get to the point where a Buddha in each realm kind of arises and shows people the way out that particular realm. But it was very difficult to do without just having a guy in robes coming along and saying, that way is the Buddhist centre kind of thing. It was very difficult to sort of show that from the actual drama. So that really kind of challenges us to do that. So there's the theme of non-self, which we talk about a lot. But what would that mean in musical terms or dramatic terms or novels or whatever? You know, what is this self? Is it a fiction? Is it a projection? Is it a kind of a puppet of our vast conditioning? But I've no time to go into that yet. Okay. Somebody's snoring. No, it's coming from here, actually. Oh, no. Hello. What are you doing? Well, I was meditating that I fell asleep. I know, but who are you? Dodi Katie Dana. Enlightened Comet of the Truth. Who ordained you? Atatria. Did you ordain him? Thank you. How long have you been ordained? 6 months. And you've got a gold case as well. Yes, I'm the Nanagarika. You can't be an anagarika, you're prepubescent. I'm 13. So it's a bit young to be an order member, isn't it? I'm part of the Young Teetles Initiative. You got a white one, I see. Yeah. Still indulging willy-nilly in hanky-panky. A sea of white. For an mature order, there's a lot of hanky-tanky going on. I think you've outstayed your welcome. I think you should. I'm trying to do a talk here. Hold your horses. Why? I could teach you something. What could you teach me? Direct pointing. How long you been ordained? 6 months. What age are you? 13. I'm 56 and I've been ordained 30 years and you want to show me how direct pointing? Yeah, all right. Now shut your eyes. Take your attention down to your feet. Okay? What do you feel? I feel my toes. I feel the soles of my feet. And direct experience only. Don't shout. Sorry. Indirect experience only. Tingling. Good. Now take your experience to your right hand. Experience. It's very complicated. Hey, take this seriously. No, I'm not. You're not even real. Now we're getting somewhere. Okay, I think it's about time to say goodbye, okay? Okay. You're not really an order member, are you? You're not even a mitra, are you? I'm not a friend. A friend of the friend. Okay. Right, bye-bye. Bye-bye, everybody. His name's really Joe Brady. Okay, oh dear. So a couple of concerns. How good does it have to be? How good does a quality have to be if we're communicating the Dharma through the arts? But then how good does any Dharma talk have to be? I suppose I think in terms of a continuum, there's some people here who, well, for writing or painting is a vocation. And I know one friend who does draft after draft after draft of the draft of a poem until it's really right. And, you know, it's producing really excellent stuff. But I don't think that kind of precludes poems or playing a guitar or whatever. I think it's a sign the importance we place on the arts, the weight we put on quality. And perhaps it's the word itself. I remember somebody asking me, why does he play the piano if he's not going to be Mozart? In a way, it's like we communicate through words and music and dance and images. And we've done it since we've been kids. You know, it's how human beings express themselves. It's how we express themselves. Dogs bark. Human beings kind of sing and play. So I think in a certain way it's quite natural. There's the other concern that it's showing off or egotistical. Fair cop. You know, you might have a particular talent or skill that we identify with, but, you know, we work with it. It's a shame that it would preclude more kind of music and fun and play. So communicating the Dharma through the arts, one thing the arts can do very well, I think, is give negative emotion a voice. Early on, we all discovered that you can't go around killing dragons. It just doesn't work because your own energy gets kind of dissipated. You know, so much of our energy is held down by condemnation and judgment. You know, and I think for myself, there was always this sense of the ideal and where I was, and I'd give myself a hammering for not, you know, being at the ideal. In The Tempest, Prospero talks about Caliban, the beast, as this thing of darkness I acknowledge as my own. And there's a lot of energy, obviously, in our kind of negative samskaras. And I think the arts is very good at giving these demons a voice so that we can access the energy. Think of Richard III or Basil Fawlty, who's a real monster, actually. But for me, he kind of, you know, I wouldn't ever want to meet him. I certainly wouldn't want to be him. And you can very much see that actions have consequences in the world of Fawlty Towers. But actually watching it, there's a kind of release there. There's an acknowledgement. Laughter, in a way, is a kind of explosive energy, isn't it? We can communicate for each other in the world the beautiful. And, you know, we've had these beauty and eros retreats that have been very successful. Communicating the beautiful sounds a bit daunting. Maybe that's because we associate beauty with the lovely and the harmonious and the tranquil, which it certainly can be. But as well as Wordsworth's daffodils, there's also Coleridge's slimy creatures of the deep. And, you know, in the religion of art, Banti talks about communicating. The artist communicating via his or her own sensibility, which is particular to us, and that may be strange. So there's the salutary tale of Nikolai Gogol, the great Russian writer. There's a Russian proverb: he who has the longest nose sees furthest. And of all these great Russian writers like Dostoevsky and Tolstoy and Chekhov, Gogol easily had the longest nose. You can see him in photographs, this very kind of long, pointy nose. And he was obsessed with noses all his life. He wrote a story called The Nose. His main character was in Dead Souls is constantly sneezing. And he was just a very, very strange man. But he also had a very strong religious sensibility. And at one point, the two came in conflict. He started becoming really dismayed by his own creations. He ended up burning the second volume of Dead Souls. He felt that he wanted to kind of rescue Russian literature and usher in a new kind of religious and spiritual age. But this seemed totally at odds with his own kind of sensibility. Which had a lot to do, I think, with fear of hell. It's very complicated, but I think what I'm trying to get at is that to communicate spiritual values, it might come in a sort of strange or indirect way. And with our understanding of the first and second noble truths, I think we're well placed to convey the tragic as well. Banti again, and I can't find this quote either, said something like tragedy being the West's great gift to civilization, to articulate dukkha and the cause of dukkha. Because to the unrepentant or the unresolved ego or self, life is tragic. You know, many people do live lives of quiet desperation. To the extent that we subscribe to the ego, to that extent, life is disappointing. And Greek tragedy was performed in the light during the day, bringing the sort of negative and the dukkha to the surface. It was played during the day. I'm rushing through this a little bit, actually. But I suppose for me, to communicate the Dharma through the arts. It's the third and fourth noble truth that I think we are most well placed to do, to convey the possibility of freedom, the sublime comedy, the laughter of Vajrasattva, to show people or show ourselves the fire exit, to kind of contact the overarching myth, to get in contact with a meaningful perspective and freedom. And I don't know about you, but I couldn't live without that sense, without that sense of a kind of fire exit, without a sense of some kind of meaning or freedom, really. And for many, many people, of course, it's not possible. And I think through the arts, we can reach ourselves, and we can reach others. And again, it really challenges us to show, don't tell. I notice when I've tried many times to write a play of the Buddha, and it's always failed. The Buddha just doesn't sound right. He either sounds too kind of folksy or too kind of, I don't know what exactly, highfalutin or something like that. And those, I'll keep trying, I think, but, you know, those plays have always been failures. My own template, for what it's worth, is One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, the book and the film, and Tarkovsky's Andrei Rublev. And in both of those, I get a sense of kind of redemption and freedom growing out of darkness and tragedy. And with this contact with the third and fourth noble truths, of course, comes a delight and a joy and a celebration. And the medium being the message, I think there's no better way to express a joy through the arts, through music and dance and story and words and pictures and images. Yeah. Okay, so I'll begin to close now. I'd just like to dedicate this talk to Alia, who's been in a nursing home for over a year, and to Ratnamala, who's been just very kind of stalwart and sees him very regularly. There are pictures of Alia in the men's community. If you don't know Alia, Alika's made available all these pictures that he's done of Alia. If you go through the men's community, just diagonally opposite, they're really, really striking images. You get a real sense of who Alia is if you look at those pictures. Okay, so let's just finish with a little visualization stroke story. You might want to shut your eyes for this. I might want to shut my eyes for it. So if you could just imagine a blue sky, above, below, in front, behind, on all sides. And in the midst of the blue sky appears a little orange dot. And this golden orange dot grows larger and larger. And at first we think it's a bird because it has wings. But as it gets closer, we see a word on the side of the object, EasyJet. And framed in the aeroplane window is a bearded face, male Caucasian, about 56 years old. And he looks worried. And he's worried because he's worried about his carbon footprint. He's worried about flying. He's worried about the direction of his spiritual life. Let's face it, he's worried. So another scene now. Honolulu Bay. So our friends lying down, trying to relax, not finding it very easy, because there are no holidays in the spiritual life, as we all know. So he decides, I'm going to meditate. Stuff this holiday lot, I'm just going to meditate. So he begins to meditate, and then he opens his eyes at one point, and he sees a golden light in the sky, and a woman appears in the golden light, in the moonlight, and he's not sure who this is. Is this Pranyaparamitastara? It's not a familiar figure. And then he remembers the Sutra of Golden Light lectures by Bhante, because this woman's seated on a goose, and she's got a lute on her knee, and she's smiling down at them, and it's Sarasvati, the bearer of culture, the goddess of culture. And she begins to sing to him. I was meditating in the moonlight on Honolulu Bay when I saw a vision in the moonlight on Honolulu Bay. A lady bathed in gold with a lute upon her knee, and in a voice as sweet as honey, the lady sang to me. If you like a ukulele lady like you, if you sing the Dharma, I'll purify your karma and make it all right for you. Dance, sing, tell a tender story in the language that the people understand. If you pass on this golden song, ukulele lady, guide your hand. And maybe they'll sigh an awful lot, maybe they'll cry and maybe not, maybe they'll come to the truth by and by. But if you sing for ukulele lady and you promise ever to be true, if you sing for ukulele lady sing for you. If you like ukulele lady like you. If you love ukulele lady love you. Thank you.